sunsets and the ghettos play. Long nights on a hot summer's block where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile again. Rise above the pain. This is for you and your crew, the ones that's true will always love you, no matter what you do.
It's the light, the light, the light, the light, the light. It's the light, the light, the light, the light. It's the light, the light, the light, your light, your light. It's the light, your light, the light.
This is for soldiers who bust their guns in the name of freedom, not the game of fun.
Spitfire views the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices. Welcome to another edition of Spitfire Radio, Women of Color Radio on CKUT FM 90.3 every last Wednesday of the month. So we have a great show for you today. First, Sabrina met with Tara Adluri, Professor of Women's Studies at York University. Professor Adluri researches race and comedy. She is also the one behind the Where's Omar street art installations in Toronto, which seek to raise awareness about the Omar Khadr case. Professor Adluri will talk to us about this project as well as identity politics and social change. Later on, Alyssa will be speaking with Tia Hicks, a senior in the Africana Studies program at Cornell University. Over the summer, Tia Hicks conducted interviews with women involved in the Black Panther Party. She will be speaking to us about that. She will also share her perspectives on gender politics in Black political movements today. Lastly, Alicia will be reviewing Canadian writer Lawrence Hill's The Book of Negroes. The novel was published in 2007 and has won numerous awards, including the Rogers Writers' Trust Fiction Prize and the Commonwealth Writers' Prize. As of last week, it had been announced that the book has sold more than 500,000 copies in Canada. So stay tuned. All this coming up next. You're listening to Easy Living by Billie Holiday on Spitfire Radio.
Whatever I do for you, for you. Maybe I'm a fool, but it's fun. People say you rule me with one wave of your hand, darling, it's grand. They just don't understand.
I'm sitting here in Toronto with Dr. Tara Adluri, who is currently an adjunct professor at York University. How would you describe yourself? What are you teaching this year, and how did How do you find classes so far this semester? What do you think of the next generation of young minds?
I'm teaching in the School of Women's Studies at York and in Crescent Point in the Sociology Department. I am teaching a course called Identity, Ethnicity, and Power in Sociology at York. And I'm also teaching a course called Queer Cultures and another one called Sexuality Studies. It's an advanced seminar in Sexuality Studies and Women's Studies. So it's been so far so good. It's only been 2 weeks. It's Women's Studies students have been good. My Queer Cultures class has been really good. My sociology students are good. I find the biggest thing is, like, I think you do notice, like, from being a graduate student to now and having taught. I just came from teaching in India. I was teaching at Delhi University in sociology, and now I'm teaching here. And I find that, yeah, the students have so many demands on them here. Like, many of them are working full-time or, you know, they have so much going on, and I find that it's hard to get them to focus. And also, just the student debt thing here. I mean, it exists in other places, but I always find North America, the amount of debt that people are in when they're in school and when they're leaving school, and it's a weight that kind of, like, it really just, I don't know, it sits on them. So I find that, yeah, it does change the ways in which people approach education here, because I feel like there's a certain amount of time that they have to get it done, and they're also really, like, they have to work a lot to not be in debt, or they're constantly thinking about how fast they have to get out because they're in so much debt.
And compared to, like, when you're in school, what are the demographics of the students? Do you think access to education is really oppressing as a problem as a lot of the student activists make it out to be? I mean, what are the barriers like nowadays for specifically women of color to get an education?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that it's really interesting is that the higher up you go, the less I will see people who look anything like me. I mean, the undergraduate level, there are, like, lots of people of color, women of color, queer people of color. There are students from working class backgrounds at the undergraduate level, especially at York because of where it's located. But the higher up you get, maybe at the master's level, you will see, like, the same, you know, people of color, you'll see students who don't come from those affluent or privileged backgrounds, but you get to the PhD level and it's slim pickings. Like, I find that to be the case, like, at any institution that I've gone to, is, like, the higher up you get, the more it becomes just really segregated.
And how have you studied so much about race and inequalities and social justice and have, like, essentially not had a breakdown and still believe in the cause?
I wrote my PhD thesis on humor and race, so I guess that's why.
What was the title of your paper?
The title of my PhD was called Off-Color Jokes, and it was about the Ali G show at Borat. So I think that's why, like, I always found, like, there, what I was really interested in, I did my master's on Margaret Cho, my master's thesis was called Lighten Up. I guess that's the thing, like, I always found it really interesting that there was a tone in which people related to academic scholarship, and they do this with activism too, where it was this tone of everyone, and I understand that, like, these things are, it's not like I don't get that racism isn't funny, or that oppression isn't funny, and that when you actually are, you know, dealing with issues like politics every day in your life and sexual harassment and sexual violence, and I worked at a women's center, and I know it's really depressing, but it's the fact that I feel like people engage with these issues only in that tone all the time, like, and I feel like it's not that there shouldn't be a tone of seriousness, but I think that one of the joys of being an academic and approaching things from a scholarly perspective is that you can have a sense of reflection, or you can create something that tries to cultivate an idea of resistance that isn't depressing, right? I begin from the premise that, like, people who understand politics and people who practice politics and people who live their lives every day in certain ways because of politics, they already know, you know, they already have 101 reasons to be depressed and to feel beaten down. And so the work of, I think, creating, like, scholarship or creating art or creating, like, political movements should be about, like, I don't know, inspiring people.
And you recently are actually involved in for lack of a better term, I call it like guerrilla street art kind of work you do. You are inciting a lot of discussion, specifically in Toronto, about recent Omar Khadr's case, and you've created this whole, you and a group created this whole campaign about Where's Omar? Can you tell us a bit about the visuals of that, where that came from, where that's going?
Well, the Paper Cranes Art Collective started in 2010 this summer. It's supposed to be an anonymous art collective. Okay, so Paper Cranes started in 2010, and we are we try to be anonymous in the art that we do. I mean, I don't mind my name being linked to it, but in terms of like when we actually do installations in the city,
right,
there's no kind of record that it's us who's done it. We might come up with a logo. I was thinking this is Paper Cranes, yeah, but it won't be linked to individuals. But there are probably, I think there were four, there are like between 6 to 8 members who are kind of active, who come and go. Some are in India now, some are in New York City, some are, I don't know, in their houses on Facebook all the time. Some are, you know, gonna hang out on the weekends and like go to parties, and we'll talk about it then. But then some do make the art and put it up. But we started the collective, I guess, I think it was just, it was just after the G20 here, and I really felt like there was a space that was created in the G20 organizing, and there was a certain feeling in the city of Toronto that I have not felt here in years, where I feel like the city's kind of opened up and people were willing to do stuff, and people were really, I think, engaged with the idea of taking up public space because it was so violently taken from us, like from people, because of, you know, police brutality and because of like just kind of the intense stuff that happened around the G20. But there was this momentum, I think, that was caused by the G20, where people really wanted to reclaim public space in Toronto. And so it started out of that moment. And we started the Where's Omar project, which was dealing with the Khadr case. And it was basically to take the image of Where's Waldo, which is a popular British children's book. It's also become popularized here, and Waldo is this figure that pops up everywhere. And the whole point is that in the children's book, you have to find, like, Waldo, and he's hiding behind things, and he's always dressed in the same red and white striped shirt and blue pants. So we did this Where's Omar project, where you put up cutouts of Omar around the city, Omar Khadr, but he looked like Waldo. So the point was just to, like, because Waldo in the books is like this missing person that nobody can find, right? So it was this idea to reflect on the Khadr case, and the Khadr case is happening now. His Omar Khadr's trial is October 18th, and he's facing military trial. He is the youngest person to face a military tribunal. He is the only citizen from a Western country to remain who has not been repatriated. In 2008, they repatriated Binyan Muhammad and other men who were there, but they have not repatriated Khadr. So the case will begin, and there was a campaign. What's really interesting is if you look back at the history of this case, there was a campaign before Stephen Harper was elected. Mm. If you look at like clips of parliamentary debate, there was constant talk of repatriation. Everyone in Canada, even like conservative MPs, were saying like, this is a threat to our national identity. Why is he in America? Bring him back. He's our citizen. And then once Stephen Harper comes into power, nothing. There is not a single debate. So we launched this project, and the point of doing it as an art project was that there have been Amnesty International campaigns going on that I fully support. People can go to the Amnesty International website and they can sign the petition. Amnesty International has come out strongly against Canada, saying that the Khadr case is an example of Canada's, like, of the new order. But my point of doing it, or our point of doing it as an art installation, I think was just to, like, just to reflect on the absence of discussion around the case in the city. Like, where is Omar? Like, where is Omar Khadr? And where is, like, the left? And where is, like, you know, the discussion about this case? It just seems to have fallen on, like, silent ears.
And what have been the effects of the works and the kind of discussion? What's the response been since you guys have started?
It's been good in terms of the arts community. I feel like we've gotten picked up by a lot of people. People are really interested in talking about it. People seem like to like the idea because it wasn't really preachy and it was sort of comical and like, I don't know, that
your expertise, not preachy, yeah, kind of comical,
like
makes
that kind of like making people think and just asking questions and also just commenting on the irony of the case that it was a children's book, whereas Waldo and Omar Khadr was 15 when he was arrested.
Yes.
And another really disturbing thing is the testimony that was obtained when he was 15 under torture, under sexual and physical torture, is now admissible in the case. They voted that it was admissible. It's a precedent-setting decision for war crimes trials. One of the things they said to him when he was, like, and this is supposedly, but, I mean, I believe him that he says that he was tortured, and he was tortured with threats like, you will be raped by a large black man, which is explicitly racist and homophobic. And yeah. So, I mean, but this, all this testimony is admissible in court. And he's 15, and the thing that I wanted to comment on was just the loss of childhood, right? Like, the Where's Waldo book is a children's book, and, like, he was 15, and he was a child soldier, right? And that, and all
and he was living in Toronto at the time,
yeah.
Right? He had a Canadian citizen.
He was born in this city. Where is he now? And, like, he was, and also I wanted to comment just on, like, yeah, the fact that he went so quickly from being a Canadian child to a Muslim man, which has happened not only to Khadr, but to people who have been detained under this Project Samosa thing, to many Muslim men at this time in Canada, that you go so quickly from being a young man or being a boy, you know, to being this, like, you know, evil monster terrorist, like, who has ultimate agency and who's obviously, you know, aligned with, like, all of these kind of, like, other images of monstrous masculinity. But what's also interesting is at the same moment, there was a bid, and there has been a bid, to build an Islamic art museum. The Aga Khan is building an Islamic art museum in Toronto. And again, massive amounts of money are going into building this,
yeah,
like, art museum at the same time this case is happening with Khadr. So I think what's also interesting about this case is that it points to the fact that when you talk about identity politics, and this is one of the ironies of, like, talking about race, and one of the reasons I always, like, gravitated towards things like humor, is people want to talk about these communities as if they're unified, as if, because you're, like, if you are an affluent Muslim who's building an art museum, what do you care about some kid who's from Afghanistan? You know what I mean? And there's a real division, I think, between these communities around class and around, and almost becoming these hyper-patriots to associate yourself with the nation state. I mean, many immigrant communities or many immigrants come here and they want to whiten themselves through money, through secularism, through being associated with, like, you know, with the good, like, liberal states, and they don't want to be associated with somebody like Khadr or with men, like, who have been detained under Project Samosa.
You have one foot in the art world, kind of the street art world. You have one foot in academia. You're wearing so many different hats. Do these identities for you coalesce at any point? What's the essence of your work and where you see it going? What do you want for yourself in the future?
I don't know. I think I'm going to write an academic piece that's going to be in a journal. There's a journal called Continent that is being started by some students at EGS, which is the European Graduate School. And they're starting this journal, which, I mean, sounds amazing, and it's going to be about politics. And they are letting me write a piece about the Khadr, specifically the Khadr case, but I will use this Where's Omar piece to write about the case. In the sense that, like, I'm really informed by the work of Chantal Mouffe, who is a European political scientist and writer, who has written a lot about critical art practices. And she says that the problem is that, I mean, we operate within liberalism. We operate within liberalism as if... As if consent can be formed, as if we're all one people, we can all get along, you know, as if there's no kind of political problem, as if there's no antagonism between people. And she says that critical art has this way of, like, revealing that there is always, like, antagonism, you know, amongst people, and that, you know, it reveals that sort of, again, like, underneath the kind of polite silences and the kind of...
Is that what you do, political art? Is that
well,
that stirs
well, what Mouffe says is that all art is political, right? And that art either kind of contributes to the silences of liberal culture and these kind of polite silences and the denials of politics, or it lays them bare, right? It makes visible the fact that behind the kind of, you know, polite, nice, genteel stories in Canadian youth, there are people like Kadar, right?
And I know you also did a performance piece before, too. Can you tell me a bit about that?
I did a performance piece called Kitchens and Bathrooms in Toronto, and I also have written a paper about that, and I'm going to be presenting the paper at Historical Materialism in London, England, in November. And the piece is a piece where I played a washroom attendant at an academic event, and I wore a sari, and I had an Indian accent, and I handed passersby these cue cards where I wrote ironic messages like, "You Marxist, I clean toilet." And it started when I was living in London, England, and there were all these bathroom attendants who were Indian women. And there was one specific bathroom attendant where I went to this academic party, and she was wearing a sari, and she looked like someone from my family. And she was like, and she told me my skirt was too short, and it was really funny. And the whole thing was great, but it was also because I was at this academic event trying to be this academic, and there were like the only other Indian woman at this academic event was like the bathroom attendant. But there was also a case at Duke University, which is really disturbing, where a student referred to his black professor, his black female professor, as a cross between a welfare queen and a bathroom attendant. And he referred to, yeah, and she, he said this publicly in the classroom. And she filed a complaint, and there's a legal case about it, and it's one of the cases that's cited about, like, hate speech in classrooms. So I used that case as well to talk about the experience of being a woman of color in academia and the idea of being like, and the interesting thing about never being able to like leave your body. I mean, that's the thing. We were talking about this earlier today about how people often use post-structuralist theory these days, like Foucault and like Stuart Hall, and they use it to say, well, race is a construct and gender is a construct, so therefore, you know, it doesn't matter that I'm a white guy and you're not. Like, but the thing is, these people, like Foucault and Hall, they begin from a critique of power always, right? And the point is if you say race is a construct, or if you say that there's irony within race, but what you always come back to, I think, as a person of color and a scholar of color, is that you can't escape your material body.
Hello. This is Amina Claudine Maris. Whenever I'm in Montreal, I like to listen to CKUT 94.3 FM.
Hey, you're listening to Spitfire Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's 6:24 p.m. and 16 degrees out, and it's cloudy. Up next, we have Alyssa, who is going to speak with Tia Hicks about gender politics in Black political movements today and women from the Black Panther Party.
Greetings. I'm talking to Tia Hicks today. Tia Hicks is a senior and student activist at Cornell University. She's a member of a number of student organizations, including the Black Women Support Network, Black Students United, Students for Ken Glover, and Students for Africana Studies. Tia has been working on women involved in the Black Panther Party this summer and got the opportunity to interview several former members. So we're going to talk to her about the Black Panther Party today and many other things. So Tia, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you doing today?
I'm good, but I can't figure out this weather. But other than that, I'm good.
I know, the weather kind of depressed me.
Yeah, it's really bad. We're talking in Ithaca, New York, in the Africana Studies and Research Center, which we are both a part of. So before we get started talking about women in the Black Panther Party, gender politics in the Black Panther Party, can you talk a little bit about yourself? Talk about how you got interested in gender politics in the Black community, how your personal experiences or interests have led you down this path.
Yeah, definitely. I actually just really began to become passionate about these issues after my junior year, because I took a class by Kara Boyce Davies here at the Africana Studies Center, and it was a Black feminist theories class. For me, it really interested me because it was the first time that I feel like I actually studied things that directly affected my personal life and my personal experiences. And I feel like with other classes that never was the case. You know, I was passionate about certain issues, but this is something that was like deeply affecting me on a personal level. And just being exposed to a lot of the readings that we read in class, it just clicked for me. and also based off of my experiences that I've had here at Cornell, being involved in student organizations and student politics, I kind of was able to see how these type of gender politics play into my personal life and my personal interactions with people. And as far as, I guess, getting involved with the Black Panther Party, I think I read an article or some kind of reading in an anthology. Somehow the issue of, like, sexism in the Black Panther Party came up, and I was never exposed to that before. I'm actually from Oakland, California, which is like the birthplace of the Black Panther Party, and both my parents benefited from it. They did the free breakfast for school children's program, and it was just something that's I've always been interested in, but I never really thought about, oh, like, there's actually, like, sexism in these organizations. Like, that's something that never, you know, like, caught, something I never thought about.
Right. So. And it's something that that kind of sort of gets glossed over in the way we talk about the Black Panthers.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like whenever we talk about the Black Panther Party, we talk about, you know, the strong men, the militant men in their guns and their leather jacket and the big fros. But, you know, actually, besides Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale, you know, Bobby Seale, based off of some of the research that I've done, I think in his autobiography, Seize the Time, he did some kind of survey. I don't know how, what the process was, but in 1969, I believe, or even early as 1968, 60% of the party were women. And you don't even hear about that. That's two-thirds of the party. And you don't even talk about that. That type of stuff is just really interesting to me. And especially when we talk about Black politics. We always talk about men. We talk about Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, W.E.B. Du Bois, these Black intellectuals, but we never talk about, I don't know, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, Rosa Parks, behind the scenes
Claudia
women,
Jones.
Claudia Jones, Anna Julia Cooper. Like, it's so many countless people that you just don't hear about.
The wives of Garvey and Du Bois who did a lot of their stuff.
Exactly.
Right. So getting more into the Black Panther Party, can you talk specifically about the ways women were involved in the Black Panther Party, their roles, their contributions?
They were pretty involved in pretty much every aspect of the organization. They were in leadership roles. You know, Kathleen Cleaver was really influential in the, I guess you can call it the revolutionary phase of the organization, where it was all about the guns and fighting the police. She was involved in organizing the Free Huey Newton campaign, and she was, I believe she was kind of the liaison to the media. You had women who really, and we don't even talk about the community service programs, you know, regarding the Black Panther Party. We always talk about the militancy, but from chapter to chapter, they had a whole bunch of different community service projects, and those were largely sustained by the women in the organization. You never talk about Elaine Brown being the chairperson of the party. She was, like, the first and only woman chairperson of the party, and, you know, when we analyze the Black Panther Party, we kind of stopped analyzing it in 1972. Like, after that, we cut it off because people believe that it didn't stay true to its revolutionary ideals because it started focusing on the community service projects. But these are where the women stepped in, and she led the party. You had women like Erica Huggins, who was really instrumental with the Oakland Community School and other liberation schools. I mean, they were really involved in they really sustained the party. I think you can probably ask any member and they probably would agree, like, they held it down.
So what were some of the challenges they faced? You were talking about how the women were especially involved in sustaining the organization and keeping up the community programs. Mm-hmm. What were some of the challenges that they faced?
I mean, I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that because of their very militant standpoint, you had a lot of state repression, like the FBI and the COINTELPRO program. They came down hard, and so a lot of the men were picked out and, you know, and harassed and arrested and beat too, but we don't talk about women being arrested as well and being beat as well. Asa Shakur, Angela Davis went to jail, a whole bunch of women went to jail. There was this case in New Haven where Erica Huggins was involved, and like four of the women who went to jail were pregnant and had babies in jail. So we never talk about that. And how, I mean, I think that in those challenges, you know, because you had men in those leadership roles, they sharply left, so they were kind of forced to just, like, you know, really hold it down after people being, you know, arrested and murdered and a whole bunch of craziness going on. They had to really just keep it on lock.
So how is the perception of gender relations in the Black Panther Party similar or different to the reality from what you've been reading and researching?
I honestly don't think people even talk about gender politics in the Black Panther Party, because it's an interesting topic to research about, because the Black Panther Party in itself is very, like, controversial. You know, people have so many different misconceptions about the actual organization and what they did. So that's a fight for one, just to legitimize that even being something to talk about. And when we do talk about it, you know, you don't really, it's just, gender politics is kind of glossed over. You don't really talk about it. But what's interesting about the Black Panther Party, though, is that, well, I take that back. When we do talk about the gender politics of the party, we do talk about how overwhelmingly sexist it was. But because of women being involved in the party, they were really able, they used their positions to really transform the organization. So you might have had very, like, sexist tendencies and patriarchal tendencies in the beginning, but towards the end of the organization, it was pretty different. And they were pretty progressive if you look at it in terms of other Black nationalist organizations. So it's really complicated, and it's really interesting, and it's a lot to be teased out of it. And I think if people pay more attention to it, we can learn a lot from it, because, you know, just being involved in the activism that I'm in on campus, I know that there's a lot of gender issues that people just don't talk about. We just don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like analyzing such a historical organization like that, you can use that to kind of look to as an example of how things right. can change.
I read some weeks ago, I think it was an article or just some sort of leaflet about the Black Panthers, and the article was sort of took note of the fact that they were the only nationalist or Black organization in 1973 to endorse Roe v. Wade when it passed. So other organizations, CORE, I think SNCC, who are seen as sort of less militant, less masculinist in terms of what we remember about them, mm-hmm. didn't endorse Roe v. Wade. They were against it because of the history of, you know, genocide and using Black women to do experiments on and sterilizing women of color. Mm-hmm. But the Black Panthers supported the Roe v. Wade, which legalized abortion.
That's really cool. I don't know if I've ever read that article, but I do know that it came out in support of a lot of different, like feminist and gender progressive initiatives, and they developed, like, childcare centers and things like that. And I think that has to do with the fact that you had a lot of women in the party. And the women, you know, they wasn't just there taking the sexism. They were, like, contesting it on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
In their living situations, in their personal interactions with men, politically, you know. Although they didn't necessarily consider themselves feminists, and they sometimes disagreed with the way that the white women's movement was going, they definitely utilized, gender was like a politicized thing back then, and they definitely took that to their advantage and kind of forced the party to, like, be progressive on certain issues, which I think is really cool.
Right. So thinking more broadly about the way that organizations like the Black Panther Party, and that there's this perception that somehow they're more sexist, that they're more machismo, and that they're more homophobic. And when I say more, I mean more than white people. Mm-hmm. This obviously is a deeply racist belief. It implies that our communities are less civilized, or are backward, or are unable to accept the civil rights that they've been given from states, etc. How do you, as an African-American woman interested in these questions, critique this perception while still critiquing the sexism present in Black politics and in Black organizations?
I think that oftentimes I feel like the patriarchy that you see replicated in the Black community is a replication of the patriarchy that exists in the dominant culture. And, you know, as men, you know, the whole politics about that is so muddy, but it's like, you know, Black men historically have been demasculated and all this type of stuff. And I feel like, in general, in efforts to kind of, like, gain some kind of power, I think that that a lot of the times that stuff has been replicated from dominant society. But I don't necessarily think that it's worse in our communities. And that's a problematic notion to think to say that, that it's worse in our communities. Because if anything, if you was to argue that, then you have to say that it was being passed down from the dominant culture.
Right.
That's what I would argue.
So how do you, in spite of the fact that that myth persists, still challenge, you know, raise questions of sexism or gender politics in these movements? Because if that perception's out there, mm-hmm. one of the strategies to combat that perception is to just sort of say, let's not air the dirty laundry, to yeah. let's just maintain a cohesive position irrespective of the way women or gender issues are treated.
For me, I feel like as people of color, you know, involved in progressive movements and social movements, I think that we have to really be about, if we're about one thing, we have to be about all things. We can't just be about race. We have to be about equality for women, equality for gay and lesbian and queer people, equality for, I mean, a whole bunch of the isms. All the isms have to be incorporated. Because I just don't think that you can build a successful movement without, like, incorporating all that type of stuff, because something's going to get left behind and something's going to be replicated. Like, if we are trying to, you know, push ourselves to be so progressive, that's very hypocritical for us not to, you know, take on all these issues, because they all affect us. And there's some serious issues within the black community, like serious issues that we have to address. And if we don't, then, I mean, how are we any better than anybody?
So do you have any impressions for how to address sexism in black politics and make the concerns of women a more prioritized part of these movements?
You know, I've like struggled with that question a lot, because it's really, I think really we have to take, as women, we have to take ourselves to task as well. Like, we can't be silent on issues. We have to keep speaking, you know, and we just have to challenge our men to do better. I don't necessarily think that it's our role to teach them to do better, but I do think that if we continue to take abuse, then that's a problem. And as women, we do that. So we have to resist it. I think that's the first step. I think that women have to speak more. We need to be in more positions of power and in leadership positions so that people can see that there's another way of how things can work. You know, we always get this very male-dominated view of, like, how to run stuff. But it's like, that's not the only way. So I think as women, we should see the strength that we naturally have and use that to our advantage in some way.
And as a young scholar interested in the Black Panther Party and the broader black nationalist movement, mm-hmm. do you see any future avenues that have been untapped that need further study, that need to be talked about, more pieces to the puzzle for us as people looking back on that movement to understand what it was really about?
Man, there's so many different things people can get into. Like, the Black Panther Party was, like, a really cool grassroots organization. I mean, obviously the gender politics, obviously the role of women in the organization we need to talk about more. I think we need to talk about, you know, how the Black Panther Party infiltrated local politics. I know in Oakland with the national chapter, you know, you had two members running for really important positions in local government. I mean, there are a whole bunch of avenues. I can't think of them all, but I'm really interested in that aspect of it because I come from, like, a city planning perspective, too, so that's kind of interesting. Really talking about, really looking at the survival programs, community programs, looking at their politics and how it's changed, the evolution of the party over time, looking at that it was a youth movement. That was, like, young people doing all that, which is really cool, and I feel like as young people on college campuses, we don't really see the power that we have. But, I mean, the stuff that happened in the 60s, that was all people our age. That was us doing it. And so I feel like, you know, looking at these movements can, I don't know, I hope they would inspire people. It inspires me not to be apathetic. Because people were dying for this, for us to be here. So, you know, it's really, we can't be lazy. We can't be all about ourselves. Like, if people were like that, then we wouldn't be here right now. So, yeah, I mean, it's a whole bunch of different aspects. It's really interesting stuff.
How do you connect what you learn from researching the Black Panthers to the kind of activism that you're engaged with at Cornell, the specific campaigns that you've been involved in?
I don't know. At Cornell, what really frustrates me is that we really, like, as Black people, we really participate in these politics that these people deal us. Like, we play with their cards. What I like about the Black Panther Party is that they made their own cards. They kind of, like, just took it and ran with it, did what they did. Granted, they were like repressed for it, but at the same time, they took a stand and said, this system, they critiqued the system is messed up. And I think that if we take a standpoint and saying that, you know, these power dynamics, this institution is messed up, then you start to rethink things. You're not thinking about how we as Black people or as people of color need to change. It's about what they can do to make this place open and acceptable for us. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's really about, like, learn. What inspires me about them is that they really just, you know, they were able to critique the society as a whole and say this whole notion of being and what's cool, what's progressive and what's good is problematic. And so that kind of inspires me a little bit.
Thank you so much for doing this. And any parting words?
Black power.
Michelle Mendege Ocello, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Keep it locked.
Better run, 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 cause daddy's home. Daddy's sweet on the board, just a little too sweet. And every night the man shall be...
Woke up and realized I was free to be anything. If it wasn't integrity with what I dreamed, I knew it couldn't be wrong and it would be done. I was born to be Earth's song, and I feel like I'm running, not away, but to take off and fly, using this life as a runaway. I feel like I'm running, not away, but to take off and fly, using this life as a runaway. Gone to sleep in other worlds I've seen, where my thoughts turn into things magical and tangible. And oh my, how fresh we would be if we took our dreams seriously. Cause I feel like I'm running, not away, but to take off and fly, using this life as a runaway. I feel like I'm running, not a way, but to take off and fly, using this life as a runaway. Like you're running, don't run away, you just take off and fly, use this lifetime as a runway. You feel like you're running, don't run away, you just take off and fly, use this lifetime as a runway. Oh yeah, take off and fly, take off and fly, take off and fly. You just fly, babe. Use this lifetime as a runway.
And many of those festivals were really celebrating the naturalness of the Earth's orbit around the sun. This song speaks of the naturalness, the natural order of the universe.
Mm-hmm. sun. Mankind is a child of the sun. First came the moon, which reflected the sun, and together the sun and the moon bore the earth. Earth, as she pleased, sighed the winds, cried the seas. Mother Nature indeed had a glorious birth. Mankind is a child of the sun, yeah. Mankind is a child of the sun. Sometimes in life there are problems and strife, and it seems that our dreams are mere figments of time, yeah. Earth, as she turns, holds the truth we could earn. See her fall, see her spring. She depends on sunshine. Mankind is a child of the sun.
You're listening to Spitfire Radio on CQUT 90.3 FM. It's 6:48, and you just heard Runaway by Georgia Ann Muldrow. This is another track by her on her album called Early, and it's called Child of the Sun. So up next, we have Alicia with a book review, Lawrence Hill's Book of Negroes.
One thing I've noticed about my reading choices is that the books I tend to enjoy most seem to be stories of depth, struggle, and adversity. For some reason, these are the stories that really capture me. I enjoy reading stories where characters need to deal with some sort of pain, and they come through the other side stronger and wiser. Perhaps this says something about me, but self-analysis aside, I recently read a book by Canadian author Lawrence Hill entitled The Book of Negroes, and I found the story, part history, part fiction, to be profoundly important. The story is a retrospective told from the voice of Aminata Diallo, a woman who was born in West Africa, captured as a child and shipped across the ocean to be relegated to slavery in South Carolina. She eventually escapes her master while in Manhattan as a young woman and actually becomes an important part of the Black Loyalist movement in support of the British during the American Revolution. During her service, she comes to play an important role in documenting what is known as the Book of Negroes, an actual historical document listing the names of about 3,000 American slaves who were promised freedom in Nova Scotia by the British. Through her various adventures, Aminata's voice becomes an important one in persuading the British to actually abolish the slave trade. What touched me so much about the story is Hill's ability to really paint vivid pictures of Aminata's experience. So he really uses her as a representative. Through her life, we are given access to the wretched, disgusting experience of American slavery. The story takes us through the horrors of being captured into slavery with the aid of other Africans. It addresses the inhumanity of the conditions on the slave ships and the lives of slaves in America. Our very own lovely Alyssa actually prepared a piece last year on Lawrence Hill discussing this very work at Queen's University back in 2008. And during that lecture, he stated that the story is really less about slavery and more about the life of a woman, about her triumphs and her adversity. This makes the story quite personal, not merely a documentation of historical facts. He also made the point that this story is as much a part of Canadian history as it is American history. After all, these black loyalists who were promised freedom in Nova Scotia by the British were actually the settlers of the very significant black Canadian community that exists in that part of Canada today. One pervasive vein of the story for me is this idea of separation. Separation from home, from family, community, language, culture, and spirituality. It doesn't really take much assessment to recognize that these separations that were experienced under slavery hundreds of years ago are actually quite pervasive today in both the Canadian and American black communities. The disintegration of the family unit and what is widely referred to as mental slavery, for example, internalized oppression, self-loathing, and inferiority, continue to be issues that we struggle with to this very day. I'd like to actually go ahead and read an excerpt from the Book of Negroes. At this point in the story, Aminata is still a child. She had been captured from her village, had witnessed the murders of her parents, and has made the journey of many months by foot in a coffle of other slaves to the western coast of Africa. As a note, the white man is referred to as Tubabu, meaning foreigner, throughout the book, and you'll hear that as I read this excerpt. The canoes pulled up to a wharf by the island, where I saw a castle on the hill. More Tubabu and men of the colors of my homeland swarmed about, loading goods and leading people. We were marched up a steep path and behind the building. I noticed that Jakura was still with us. Ahead lay two penned areas, side by side, bordered by sharpened stakes jutting out of the ground to the height of two men. The captors pushed open the gates and shoved the men into one pen and the women and children into another. I looked back for Jakura, but he was gone. I couldn't see Fanta either. Perhaps I could find Sanu with her baby. There they were, 20 steps to my left. I wasn't bound anymore, so I ran over to be with them. Two Tubabu with fire sticks guarded my penned area, but men of my homeland also stood ready with clubs, knives, and fire sticks. Locked inside this pen, naked, sore, and bleeding, we stood tight together in sandy soil that stank of urine and feces. We waited and watched as the sun edged across the sky. They brought us boiled millet and dumped it into a trough. Some of the women picked at it. I couldn't bring myself to do so, but when we were past calabashes of water, I did drink. Women from my homeland washed us with cold water and rubbed palm oil on our skin to make us look healthy and shiny. Inside our pen, homelander women who were clothed and cold-eyed dragged one female captive to a corner where Tubabu and homelander men stood waiting with a metal device heating over glowing embers. I looked away but heard the woman screaming as if someone had torn off her arm. I vowed not to give them the pleasure of my pain, but when my turn came, I surrendered to their coarseness and their stink. They dragged me to the branding corner. Their wounding metal was curved like a giant insect. As they brought it toward me, I defecated. They aimed a finger's length above my right nipple and pressed it into my flesh. I could smell the burning. The pain ran through me like hot waves of lava. The people who had been pinning me down let me go. I could only think of heat and of pain. I could not move. I opened my mouth, but no sound came. Finally, I heard a moan escape my lips. Arms around me, another woman's scream, and I was gone. When I awoke, I was unsure how far the sun had moved in the sky, or if it had moved at all. Then I slept again. I thought I dreamed that Jakura was touching my hand. Big men were grabbing him, pinning him as he cried out in protest. When I woke again, my chest was still burning. The heat twirled and danced under the ugly, raised welt on my chest. All of the other women had the same welt. I couldn't sleep that night. When it began to rain, I stood. At least a good rainfall would clean me. I liked the cool water running down my face. It was good to see the mud sliding off my legs, but I cupped a hand over my raw wound to protect it. The rain felt soothing until the thunder rolled in and the lightning began lighting up the sky. Water fell on me as if it were being dropped from 100 buckets, and the thunder boomed in the night, echoing over and over again in the mountains. The rain kept up with such fierceness that I prayed for it not to sweep us all into the big river below. In the women's pen, some 20 of us huddled together in the storm. I held Fanta with one hand, Sanu with the other. The noise was such that it drowned out the crying of Sanu's baby. When the explosion from the cloud ceased, we found ourselves in a field of mud up to our ankles. We spent the whole night standing. If you have any interest in learning more about Lawrence Hill and his books, I would encourage you to visit him online at www.lawrencehill.com.
Turn me up. I want to hear the music.
Yeah.
I want to feel that vibe.
Turn it up.
Are we on the air?
You
didn't hear?
All over the world, man. Gotta make that money, man. Make your money, y'all. Just do what you got to do.
Okay, so that's the end of our show for this month. Thank you for tuning in. We have a few events for you. The campaign for missing justice, so missing and murdered Indigenous women, will be holding a panel discussion at 7 p.m. tomorrow. That's Thursday, September 30th, at the Centre Saint-Pierre, which is 1212 Fanet, room 1205, and it's Beaudry Metro. There will also be a vigil to commemorate the missing and murdered in Indigenous women on Monday, October 4th at 6 p.m. And it will begin at 6 p.m., like I said, at Cabot Square. That's St. Catherine in Atwater near Metro Atwater. Yeah, that does it for another edition of Spitfire Radio. And if you have any comments or if you would like to write to us, please don't be shy. Our email address is spitfire@kut.ca. That's S-P-I-T-F-I-Y-A-H, Spitfire. And we also have a blog. It's spitfire.blogspot.com, where we put up archives of our show. So have a good month.
Don't let go, don't want much, just want